Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 7 of the Historic Performance Podcast. I'm your host, James Darley. I appreciate the continued support via social media and iTunes. I want to thank those that have shared episodes via Twitter and Facebook, plus those that have taken the time to write a review for the podcast on iTunes. All of this helps with the continued growth of the program and allows these ideas to be shared with people throughout the world. If you enjoy the content, please make sure to follow me via Twitter at Historic Perform. That is at HISTORIC Perform to keep up to date with all the latest episodes. And please take the time to write a review via iTunes. The link will be provided on each published podcast episode under the guest contact information. So today's guest is Aidan Oakley. Unlike our previous guest, Aidan has primarily worked in rugby league, although his most recent position was with a soccer club in Qatar. Within the episode, we talk about Aidan's experiences as a strength conditioning intern with Mike Boyle in Boston, Massachusetts, how that impacted his career, his time with the London Broncos, and how he ended up making the transition working with soccer players in Qatar, as well as his experiences dealing with rugby players versus soccer players in the strength and conditioning setting. So lots of great information, and let's get started. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Historic Performance Podcast. Today, I have Aidan Oakley. Aidan is going to be the first person on the podcast who's not specifically going to be talking about soccer. Today, we're going to be talking about rugby. Aidan, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, James. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. I greatly appreciate it.
No problem.
So, Aidan, to start us off, can you give us some information regarding your education background?
Yeah. So I did my undergrad degree at the University of Birmingham in England in sports and exercise science. From that, or during that time, I was playing rugby or rugby league academy level during the first 2 years, and was fortunate enough to have a sports scholarship at that uni. And then upon sort of finishing that, I wanted to get into first and see, having experienced it, and I was told, you know, you need two things, an MSc and experience. So straight off the back of finishing uni, I went over to the States and interned at Mike Boyle for 3 months, and then came back to England and did my master's in strength and conditioning at Middlesex University, and then did a year-long internship at London Broncos, which was the club I played in the academy for.
Perfect. So just for our viewers out there, because there's a lot of Americans, there's three main types of rugby: rugby union, rugby league, and then rugby sevens.
Yeah.
Could you give us a brief overview of the difference between the three of them?
Yeah. So I'll start with rugby league. It's the one I probably know best, and it's probably the easiest for Americans to sort of grasp the concept of it. So it's similar to American football. Instead of having 4 downs to get 10 yards, we get 6 tackles to score a try. Otherwise, we turn over the ball. They have 13 players. They play for 18 minutes. You attack and defend. There's no sort of offense and defense where you come off and have a rest. So you have sort of the stamina of a football player, but the contact element of American football. Rugby union's probably, you know, the most well-known. America just had their team in the Rugby World Cup over here in England. So that's 15 players, again, similar to rugby league. It's an 80-minute game, but it's a lot more technical. There's a bigger discrepancy between the players. So they're split forwards and backs. I was a back, so I was one of the quicker ones, and I like to say the the forwards are more of the donkeys that did the grunt work up front. So, yeah, they'd make a lot of the tackles, do a lot of carries, and then the backs were the pretty boys that finished it off. They have things like line-outs, which are similar to throw-ins in sort of soccer, to restart the game. There's scrums, which is kind of like a different version of a scrimmage for you guys to get the ball started in there, and then rucks and mauls, which is when you get tackled, you either go to your feet or you go to the floor and sort of have people clear out over you, or you get held up and people drive into you. So that's really the biggest difference between rugby league and rugby union, because rugby league, once you're tackled, the defenders have to get off you and get back 10 metres, so it's a bit more sort of stop-start and a bit controlled. And then rugby sevens is the same rules as rugby 15s, played on a full pitch, but seven players, 7 minute halves, so 14 minutes in total. So there's a lot more space and a lot more running. And you've got to be sort of super fit and, you know, really quick to sort of excel at that game. And I think that's catching on massively at the college scene in America.
Yep, here in America, it seems to be rugby sevens and also rugby union. There's a large university league. I believe it has about 14 or 15 universities that participate in 15 on 15 rugby union. So
okay, it's catching on slowly over there.
Yeah, rugby league is not really seen from what I know.
Yeah, it's grown out there slowly. I mean, it tends to be more of an Australian sport. But actually, when I came over and interned with Mike Boyles, there is a league. I think it's about 10 teams now. It's the USARL. And I played for the Boston 13s for a couple of months while I was over there. But yeah, it's slowly growing. I think rugby as a whole in America is sort of slowly, you know, picking up. And I think the similarities between sort of American football help. And yeah, once you guys, you know, learn the in and outs of it, you know, physically, you know, America is going to be dominating the sport pretty soon. So watch this space.
Yeah, I think it's a good time to have you on, because it's a growing sport, and it's always good to get people who have worked internationally to come on here and discuss some of the things that they've done in order to help create that dialogue.
Yeah, absolutely.
So Aiden, you mentioned that you did an internship at Mike Boyle. Mike Boyle up in Boston, pretty well-known strength and conditioning coach. So how did you hear about the opportunity?
Well, like I said, you know, once I was finishing up my undergrad degree, I was looking for internships. And I think one of the strength coaches that was coaching me at my university mentioned Mike. So I jumped online, sort of Googled him and saw they ran an internship program. So I was really looking to go out to America at that point. You know, I'd been in touch with the Boston 13s about coming over and playing in their season. It just kind of came together nicely. I sent them an email, explained the situation, that I was looking to get experience. So, yeah, it sort of went from there. You know, I had to send over a video of me coaching and a video about myself, really, just so they can get a grasp of what kind of person you're in. And then it was like, yeah, you know, that it's happening. So I packed my bags and sort of said goodbye to my girlfriend and disappeared for 3 months.
So once you actually got over here, what sport specifically did you work with at Boyle?
So it was a whole host of sports. So I came just as they were starting their summer program. So you had kids that were, you know, ranging from 12 years old up to college guys. I think one guy was looking to be a long snapper in the NFL, so was preparing for that. You know, you had girls soccer, you had ice hockey, there was a few basketball, a lot of college kids that, you know, were just coming from working out in the summer. You had sort of adults that were just sort of trying to keep in shape. So it was a real sort of mix. And for me especially, you know, there's a lot of American sports that I hadn't been exposed to before. So just being around those athletes, but equally the coaches that sort of knew more about it, was a good sort of learning experience for me.
Yeah, definitely. And I've heard that from several other people who have come on the podcast and done internships in the United States. One of them did an internship at IMG Academy down in Florida. And he also mentioned how it was great to work with other sports outside. He specifically worked in soccer, but it was great to work with a variety of sports like lacrosse and golf and tennis, things that he hadn't been exposed to in England.
Yeah, and I think obviously you guys have sort of grasped strength and conditioning long before it sort of came to the UK. So everything out there, you know, it's the stigma that America, everything's bigger and better. I'm used to being in, you know, a gym that's maybe the size of a squash court, and that was our high performance gym. You walk into Mike's, it's like a warehouse kitted out with turf and all the equipment. It's like, okay, you know, this is a lot different to what I'm used to. And, you know, it's a great experience. And you know, they had all the toys, the coaches knew what they were doing, and, you know, great systems in place, great coaches. It's just, you know, for me, it was a really good learning experience. It's my sort of first sort of get my toes wet in the field.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because it's come up several times. Some of them have visited universities and they're like, wow, I couldn't believe the amount of equipment and how large the strength and conditioning gyms were.
Yeah, it's unreal. You know, it's slowly catching on sort of in the UK. But again, for us, university sports, you know, is nothing. You know, we were lucky if we had about 10 people turn up to watch, you know, our first team play at university in the top league in the country. You know, you compare that to sort of the NCAA, sort of American football, and you've got, you know, packed stadiums, and that's really what we're having to work with. So for me to almost step outside of what I'd known in the UK and sort of see, you know, it's effectively a professional sort of team competing at the college level. And it will surpass a lot of our professional leagues over here. So it was a good sort of insight into, you know, for a culture that wants to be the best and then sort of strives to it.
No, definitely. So throughout your 3 months there, as you mentioned, you worked with a variety of athletes. What were some key points that you took away from the internship?
Coaching, you know, how to coach. You know, Mike sort of made no qualms when you get there. He sort of laid out his program. This is my program. I know it works. You know, and, you know, who am I to argue with him? I'm just starting out in the field. He's got all those years of experience. So it's like, right, learn to coach. These are what the movements are going to be. This is how you coach it individually to a large group. This is how you progress it for the guys that can do it. This is how you progress it for those that can't. And, you know, you might go from coaching one group of, you know, a bunch of 12-year-old kids. So your next group being sort of the guys that were just finishing college and, you know, they're on a similar program, but how you interact with them, how you coach with them, slightly different. The level of progression and regression that they need, it's, you know, it was sort of long days on your feet coaching. But yeah, I don't know how many hours I amassed coaching when I was there, but, you know, it put me in good stead sort of coming back to the UK and coaching.
So after your internship with Boyle, you mentioned that you went over to the London Broncos, where you had been an academy player. What role did you take?
When I went back to intern.
Yeah, when you went back to London, I believe you said that you went back to the Broncos.
Yeah. So again, I was fortunate enough. I just got in touch with my old academy S&C coach, who was the assistant coach for the first team there. So I went in as an intern with the first team for the year. And then shortly into that, the guy who was heading up the academy there left. So I took that on as well. So did the academy in the evenings and then was with the first team during the day.
So when we're talking about an academy in rugby, you have your scholarship players and then you have your full-time academy players. Is that the way it works?
So it's just the terminology. So the first team are obviously the professional guys that we have in. For us, the academy, we had two age groups in it. It was an under 20 age group and then an under 18s. So these guys would work full-time jobs or be in education around that, and they'd come in the evenings, predominantly three times a week. And then up beneath that, we had scholarship, which was an under 15, under 16 age group, and they train once or twice a week. And then play for clubs elsewhere. So again, because there's less money involved in the UK, and, you know, rugby league in the UK is the poorer of the two rugbies. So it's not as if we can have these guys training full time. So it presents some challenges that way.
That's actually perfect, and I think it sets the stage here
because the same thing happens here. Many of the people are not full-time. They have separate jobs, especially in a university setting. So I think it's great to have you on because you know those challenges and experiences, and a lot of the coaches here have brought that up. You know, how do we do strength and conditioning with a minimal budget and with minimal amount of time?
Yeah.
So working with, I know you've worked a little bit with rugby union, predominantly rugby league, both at the academy setting. So you've worked with age range between 16 to 21.
Yeah.
How is the training different between the two?
So between the two different roles that I had, when I was working in rugby league, with the academy, you know, I was with that squad, three times a week when they trained. So they do a field session for about an hour, and then they come into the gym with me in an hour. And then I'd be with them on game day. So I was there the whole time they were training. When I was working with Rugby Union, I was working at the Scottish Institute of Sport. And we were contracted to the Scottish Rugby Union, where we would only provide the strength and conditioning service to them. So they would train with me for an hour and a half on a Monday, Wednesday and Friday. But then they'd then play at a club that I'd have no involvement with. On a Tuesday and Thursday, they'd train with them and then play on a Saturday. So for me, I had a lot less control over the program they did. And yeah, I wasn't with them on game day. They were at different clubs altogether. So that was a different challenge. In terms of, you know, training them physically, there's a few nuances that you'd probably say are slightly different between the sports. But ultimately, you know, it's an 80-minute game that they both play. It's a collision sport, so they need to be fit enough to compete for 80 minutes. You know, they've got to be strong enough and fast enough and robust enough to be able to sort of break tackles and deal with tackles and, you know, produce a lot of force in a short amount of time to win the collision. So in terms of, you know, the foundation of it all, you know, it wasn't too different. My guys would squat, they'd bench, they'd chin, they'd do cleans, they'd do jumps and plyos. Ultimately trying to get them stronger, fitter, faster. You know, especially with the rugby league, there's less sort of difference between the positions because it's not as technical as rugby union. You know, like I've said, with rugby union, the scrums, the forwards in that have to scrummage, so that is their specific role. Within that, they kind of get broken down into the big fat guys you'll see on TV are the props. You know, their main job at the front of the scrum is to scrummage, is to drive forward. Behind them, you've then got two second rows who, yes, they're in the scrum and they push, but in the lineouts, like I said, are like throw-ins in soccer, apart from you can lift the guy to jump. So their main role within that is, you know, they have to be explosive and be able to jump to win the ball at the lineout. Behind them, you then sort of have your back row, and at the breakdown, when you get tackled, it's their job to sort of get over the ball, turn the ball over from the opposition, or to make tackles and get up and make tackles again. So for them, it's more of a work capacity you sort of want to develop. At the same time of them still being able to play rugby, to get around the park for 80 minutes. So the program as a whole is quite similar, but then they have specific exercises that they might need to work on to make them better at their position specific duties. But yeah, the foundation is pretty much the same. It's get these guys strong, get them fast, get them powerful. And again, it's, you know, squat, bench, chin is your staples to achieve that.
When you were working for the Scots Institute and you were contracted out, so you were just working with the rugby players in a gym-based setting.
Yeah. So, I had multiple different sports that I'd worked with during the week, and for an hour and a half on 3 days, it would be in the gym with the rugby guys. Again, around that, I could fit in some conditioning and some speed work, but I wasn't there for their technical, tactical sessions. So it was trying to give them enough of a stimulus of things that I thought they needed without, you know, necessarily having the bigger picture of what their head coach that their club's doing, or, you know, how much game time they're getting on the weekend. So, yeah, it's less control, but predominantly just gym.
So in rugby league, where you had slightly more control, can you go into more specifics in terms of speed work that you would use, conditioning work that you would use, breaking it down between preseason and then in season?
Yeah. Again, for me, like I said, the guy who was running the academy left just at the end of the preseason. So the majority of the work I did with the guys was in season. So what we tend to do is, depending on when we played, you know, if we had a Saturday game, we'd have a Sunday off, we'd be back in on a Monday. And again, because these guys worked, we were pretty much fixed to Monday, Wednesdays. Friday was like a captain's run, and then we'd play on a Saturday. So we couldn't sort of adjust the training days based on, you know, if we had a Sunday game, we'd still have to be in on a Monday. We just had to then change up what we do on that. But for me, a lot of my speed work, because we only had about an hour of session with the guys, I'd take the warm-up and I'd do some speed drills and, you know, build up into some sprints within the warm-up, and then pass them on to the technical coach. And then again, conditioning, it was what we were fortunate enough to have there is some very athletic players. But we're based in the south of England, and rugby league in the UK is predominantly a northern sport. So we were the only professional rugby league club in the south of England. So a lot of our players grow up either playing football or playing rugby union. So for us to get the conditioning element into them was important, but equally exposing them to rugby league and, you know, trying to give them as much stimulus to the sport as possible was played a big part in what we did. So we did a lot of conditioning games, which is a big part of rugby league conditioning anyway. We'll do modified games so that, you know, we can get the distance they cover and the meters per minute that they'll cover in a game. We want to surpass that in training. You know, trying to do that in a traditional game sense, you're limited by the collision. You know, it makes it a lot of stop starts. So what we do with our conditioning games is we play sort of variations of offside touch. So a bit more, I should have said this earlier, in both rugbies, you can only pass backwards. So offside touch for us was a bit more like American football, where you could pass forward. And we'd put in sort of different conditions and different rules to manipulate the game. But by playing that sort of conditioning game there, it allowed the guys to accumulate sort of high meters per minute and cover a greater distance. So that was our predominantly field-based sort of conditioning there. And then if there were injured guys or guys that couldn't do contact, I'd then take them to the side and do individual work with them or within the gym. You know, we'd have a treadmill or put them on a rower as and when we could. But it was predominantly based around the on-field work.
Since rugby is a predominantly contact sport, and unlike American football, you don't have a ton of padding. You basically have nothing.
Yeah.
So two major concerns, obviously, concussions, and also a lot of these guys are going to have really banged up shoulders.
Yeah.
What were some concussion prevention strategies that you would use both with rugby union and rugby league in order to try to kind of bulletproof the body and try to prevent people from getting concussions?
Yeah. So if I'm honest, concussion wasn't really one of the biggest issues that we had. I guess the biggest thing to prevent concussion or to sort of an injury prevention sort of point of view, it's just good tackle technique. You know, our guys got concussed when they got their head the wrong side of the tackle and took a knee to the head. I don't think any amount of prevention is going to help you there. So we spent a lot of time working on the tackle technique with the players. But again, it just sort of formed an aside part of our gym program, just an extra at the end. So it would be predominantly sort of just neck isometrics are probably the biggest thing for us. You know, either be it with a rubber band that you're having to sort of resist against sort of laterally and sort of front and behind, or predominantly with my props in rugby union. You know, yes, it plays a part in concussion, but in terms of the scrum, neck strength is a a massive part of what they need to be good at, because they're effectively holding their opposition up and trying to hold the scrum up with their necks. So we'd have guys sort of supine on a bench, you know, with their bum on the floor, rest their neck on the bench and then lift their hips. It's almost like a glute bridge with your neck supporting your weight. And that was sort of what we did there. Again, I'm not the technical coach working on the tactical or on the tackle technique or the scrum technique. So a lot of that comes to them. For me, it was just trying to strengthen the muscles around that area. And again, making the guys strong and powerful helps, because they, you know, the stronger, more powerful guy, if they can tackle properly, comes off better in the tackle situation. So if we can get our guys dominating the other team, then there's less chance that they're going to knock themselves out.
Absolutely. I know Mike Boyle is a big guy of unilateral legwork or single legwork.
Yeah.
So what types of modalities did you use for lower body training, especially since a lot of rugby players tend to have some shoulder limitation from being banged up? Would you utilize the barbell back squat, or were you predominantly just using dumbbells and kettlebells and barbells for single leg work?
No. So for me, if my guys could back squat, you know, they'd back squat. Again, we were contracted to the Scottish Rugby Union. And again, throughout their system, they sort of have sort of standards that they want guys to meet. And one of their standards is within the back squat. So they could sort of track and see where players were progressing towards their first team or their national team. So if they could back squat, they'd back squat. You know, it's a great exercise. It's a whole body exercise and it's relevant to rugby. You know, you're having to overcome higher sort of load through the body, maintaining good posture, which is what you want from the tackle. So yeah, if they could back squat, they'd back squat. You know, if not, you know, we had trap bars or hex bars that they'd use and load them up on that. We'd load them up on the leg press. You know, one guy coming back from a shoulder reconstruction, he was loaded up on a sled and literally just dragged the sled on a waist belt behind him, turned around and then dragged it forward. You know, I think I've only come across one guy when I was working at the first team at Broncos that was more comfortable front squatting than he was back squatting, just out of preference. It suited his lower back, so he, you know, he front squatted. For me personally, I don't get caught up. You know, if I can load the legs, you know, X, Y, or Z sort of variations, then I'll do it. As long as they're getting the load and getting the stimulus and getting stronger, I'm not too hung up if they can't do a back squat. That being said, you know, working with the academy boys, part of my role is sort of athletic development, you know, making them better athletes, helping them move better. And I think single leg work or, you know, unilateral work that sort of Mike's a big fan of plays its part in that. So my guys would do their main lift, which might be a front squat, back squat, trap bar deadlift, but then they do some sort of accessory stuff later on in the session that might be, you know, a dumbbell lunge, it might be a step up, it might be a split squat. You know, for me, it was get the load bilaterally and then, you know, still give them load, but, you know, make sure they're moving well in a unilateral pattern.
Yeah, and that makes total sense, especially from a rugby standpoint where you said that you want them to be able to achieve specific strength markers and load. So obviously bilateral exercises are going to lend themselves more to that than unilateral.
Yeah, but, you know, equally, you know, potentially one drives up the other as well. So it's not sort of the be all and end all that I'm a unilateral guy or a bilateral guy. You know, I want my guys stronger and I want them better rugby players. So, if, you know, using both of those modalities works. You know, at the end of the day, I want better athletes. I'm not too fussed, you know, how I get them there.
Yep, and that's of course the way it should be. So another aspect of rugby is rotation, being able to rotate and create power and speed in order to pass. So one of the questions that I had was also what type of rotational movements or trunk movements / core movements would you use with your players?
Yeah, so again, not so much from a passing perspective. because, you know, with 13 to 15 guys on the pitch, usually the guys that, you know, the passing distance that they'll have to cover is probably, you know, a couple of meters at best. It tends to be more skillful guys that can throw the longer passes or need to throw the longer passes. And that's more of a skill, you know. I've seen guys that are ridiculously strong in the gym, but you try and get them to pass over, you know, a greater distance than they used to, and it all goes horribly wrong because it is such a skill. Predominantly, you know, when I'm focusing on rotational movements in the gym, it's more to drive up their contact and their wrestle. But there's, again, there's carryover within them both. And from a rugby perspective, you know, we want our guys to produce force and be able to withstand it, so reducing it. In rugby league, if we sort of, we take an upright carry into the tackle and guys are trying to wrestle us, it's, you know, in our best interest to be able to withstand them trying to sort of turn us onto the back. So we've got to be strong there. But equally, if we're trying to turn someone, we've got to have good rotational strength and power. So for me, you know, one of the simple sort of anti-rotations ones I do, obviously the Powell-off press, you know, coming from Mike's place, John Powell-off there, I think he was the guy that sort of pioneered it. And it's just, you know, if you've got a Kaiser or a cable machine, it's just pulling that out in front of you, keeping your arm straight, trying to resist it pulling in. And again, that's not always the situation. You know, I'm not always blessed to be in the best equipped gym. So what I did with my rugby guys is it was, again, just strength bands. I just had two of them standing facing each other and just holding the band at arm's length, and both of them trying to give a bit of resistance to the other whilst resisting being pulled in. You know, that works as a basic level of being able to reduce force. In terms of producing it, we do sort of a lot of med ball work, so a lot of rotational med balls. We do like plate chops or chops on a pulley machine, so just pulling down and, you know, getting them stronger through that that motion. And again, athletic development, can they keep everything stable whilst performing a chopping motion or a cable lift? And then from that, you know, you can take them to standing, so it's a bit more leg drive coming into it to stimulate the tackle a bit more. And again, we do variations where we'd stick a barbell sort of into the edge of the rack, so the guys would hold one end and the other end would be in a rack, put some weight in, and they'd do sort of half moons, so they'd rotate to one side, stabilizing and reducing that force as they go down, so it's nice control, and exploding back up. So again, it's just similar to what I said about, you know, the lower body strength with the guys. It's not a means to an end as such. You know, I want them to drive, you know, one aspect up to get stronger there, but equally it carries over to the other side where they're increasing power in that movement. And then it goes over to the wrestle aspect. So especially in league, we spend a lot of time wrestling. So from that, you know, there's no point training like Tarzan in the gym and then as soon as we get into a wrestle session, performing like Jane. So, you know, for me, it's the biggest carryover is getting it onto the pitch and practicing the sport. So from a passing perspective, you know, I think just getting stronger through your legs, being more explosive through your legs and being able to rotate, perform chops and lifts through that. But then working on the technical aspect of passing, I think being able to, you know, to perfect that skill is going to drive up your passing ability more than the gym-based stuff.
Aiden, let's say you were in a perfect situation. You were not limited with your amount of time. How much time do you think a rugby player, and we're talking about rugby league in this instance, should spend per week solely on strength and conditioning?
You know, if in pre-season, you know, we would do up to 4 gym sessions a week, depending on sort of how you want to split that. You know, depending on time, it might be a whole body session, or what we did is we'd sort of have a lows day, an uppers day, a lows day, an uppers day sort of during that pre-season. And then when it comes to in-season, you know, you're kind of at the mercy of how your players hold up on the weekend. You know, in a professional setting, we'd tend to spend about 2 1-hour sessions a week in season, just because the guys are so beaten up. that they need time to recover. Again, with my academy boys, they were three times a week. But yeah, the physicality of rugby's, you know, can't be ignored. You know, it is a physical sport. The stronger, more powerful guys are nine times out of 10 going to dominate, you know, the guys that aren't as strong and aren't as powerful. So, you know, we put a huge emphasis on it because it is a collision sport. So, you know, those four sessions a week in pre-season, and then in season, it's just as important. You know, for us, it's not a massive sort of off season that the NFL guys get, and then a relatively short in season. You know, we get potentially 2 to 3 months in pre-season, then you've got up to 30 odd games of the in season to maintain your strength. And obviously, you're not going to maintain for 30 weeks. So it's still about chasing strength gains and trying to get your guys as fit and strong throughout the season. And again, because it culminates in the finals and the playoffs at the end of season, you know, you want to make sure that you are as strong, or if not stronger, than you start the season. There's no point just maintaining and being weak as by the time you get to the finals and getting dominated. So yeah, it's a massive part of rugby. But you know, like I said, the Rugby World Cup's on at the minute, and the New Zealand All Blacks, who are by far the best team out there, you know, physically and skillfully, are dominating. And you know, England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, who probably aren't as skillful, have all failed to qualify for the semi-finals. But, you know, I'm sure they've all put a huge emphasis on strength and power work. But when you get to that level, you know, it's not, you know, it's not going to be good enough to be strong and powerful if you're not as skillful as the opposition. You know, it's a sport that requires strength and power, but you know, you've got to be able to catch and pass and score tries to win the game. So it's equally as important that the guys get to play rugby and develop that skill. You know, you hear a lot of people, especially with younger athletes, is, oh, we'll get them in the gym, we'll get them strong, and they'll be, you know, great rugby players. One of the props I had when I was in Scotland came over late to rugby. I think he was a shot putter before, so he was really strong. As a prop, you know, his main job was to scrummage, and you know, he needed more experience and more time to develop that skill, because he's getting, you know, coming up against guys that have been playing it a lot longer, that are more skillful in that area. So they might not be as strong, but they can express their strength in a better technical model, and you know, he's going to get found out that way. So it's a balancing act between, you know, getting them strong and powerful, but being good at the sport. You know, at the end of the day, they are there to play rugby and not be bodybuilders or powerlifters or CrossFitters, if you want. You know, it's that fine balancing act.
Yep, and the reason I was asking that question is I reached out to a couple of people that are involved here in the States, and they're technical coaches, so they work on the technical aspects. And one of the questions that they had, they have a limited amount of time, limited resources. So should they be focusing on technical sessions, or should they be using that time for strength and conditioning as well? And I think this basically just answered that, which is you have to be a good rugby player. You have to be skillful, but you also have to be strong and powerful. So perhaps for them, it might be better to provide the players with a program that they can do on their own in terms of strength and conditioning. And since many of these people are fairly new to rugby, focus on the technicality of it.
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's, again, it's not making light of our profession, but it's relatively easy to get someone that's not gotten it, you know, experience of strength training. It's easier to get them strong, but you know, if you're trying to teach someone to play a new sport, or you know, a novice that hasn't got a great technical tactical understanding, yeah, your time's going to be better invested coaching them at the sport, you know, and getting them better at that, and then they can do their stuff to the side. And again, it's just about managing the time wisely and figuring out what works best in that situation.
So after working with rugby in England for a while, you ended up taking a position in Qatar, actually working with soccer. So could you tell us a little bit about your experiences there? What made you interested working with soccer players, and what were you able to carry over from rugby to soccer,
if anything? I think for me it was, you know, the opportunity to go and work in soccer in a sport that I hadn't worked in before, in the Middle East, you know, completely different surroundings. Much nicer weather, a lot warmer, a bit more sunshine than Scotland. So, you know, it was a good challenge for me that I felt, you know, I'd go and sort of see what the dark side's like and try my hand in that. And again, it was a relatively good experience. Again, we didn't have the best facilities in terms of the gym. I went in there kind of expecting the attitude of the soccer players to be, you know, what you expect. Oh, we're not doing gym work. We're not working hard. You know, we're football players. We're here to play football. But in reality, you know, the guys were really good. You know, you said to them, we're doing this. This is why we're doing it. And, you know, 95% of them bought in and got on with it. Again, they haven't got a massive sort of strength training background out there, or much of a sporting culture. I think they're starting to develop that now. So a lot of the work we did was, you know, again, athletic development, working on their movements, but again, just slowly exposing them to, you know, weight training. And for me, seeing the benefits that, you know, getting stronger and more powerful in a rugby setting, you know, the transfer over to football is going to be similar. You know, we don't want to get the guys as big and do, you know, much hypertrophy work with them, but equally, you know, if you get stronger and more powerful and you can run faster and jump higher, you know, that's only a good thing if you're playing soccer and, you know, trying to beat a defender or jump up for a header. So for us, it was a lot of explaining to the players, you know, this is why we're doing this. If we're doing the anti-rotation work, it's okay. You're trying to hold up the ball and someone's trying to, you know, get round you or push you over. If you can be strong here, you know, you can resist that. And they're like, okay, yeah, we understand what we're doing. We'll do it. The biggest challenge I think I had with them was, you know, finding the level of intensity that I'm used to working in rugby. You know, rugby's got a gym culture. If you're not big and strong, then you're going to get found out on the pitch. So a lot of the guys buy into it. You know, I want to get big, I want to get strong, because they see the benefits. In football, you know, beside a sort of injury prevention point of view, you can almost get away with not doing the strength training because it is such a highly skilled game. You know, I don't care if you can't do a single leg squat. If you're the most skillful player on the pitch, you know, you're going to outrun people. You're going to, you know, use your skill to get around them, to put yourself in a position to either score or set up a teammate. You know, no amount of strength training is going to make you a better footballer in that aspect. But we'd have guys that would tend to, well, what they did is say we were doing like a bench press and then we were doing a split squat. These guys would be bench pressing more than they could split squat. And, you know, you look at the size of the upper body muscles compared to the lower body muscles, and you're like, yeah, something's not right there. So for us, it was kind of not so much educating them in a way. We educated them in what we were trying to achieve and why we were doing it. But it was more giving them the gentle nudge in the right direction. So, you know, the biggest thing I found is we'd let the guys self-select the weights because they were just starting out. And we had a range of athletes. Some guys, you know, were pretty good lifters that could handle quite a decent load. And then there are other guys that had never done it before. So we just kind of let them sort of feel their way into the program because it was quite new and something that they hadn't done before. But for me to get around that is, you know, it was just a little thing. But say for the session we were going to do, we were doing like a single arm dumbbell row, a dumbbell bench press and a dumbbell split squat. I'd lay out, say, like 6 kilos up to 20 kilos for the guys. And they'd select whatever weight they needed for that particular exercise. And just as the weeks went on, I slowly took out the bottom weight. So, you know, the 6 kilo stayed on the rack and an 8 kilo came as the lowest number. And then, you know, the 20 got replaced by a 22 or 24. And that became, you know, the heaviest weight as an option. And without having to push guys in that general direction, they kind of figured out sooner or later, like, okay, I can lift this weight. And you'd be suggesting to them, like, oh, you know, have you tried this? And they'd be like, oh, I want to try, you know, 2 kilos heavier. And if we'd have tried to do that at the start, you know, forcing them to lift weights, they'd be like, oh, no, it's too heavy. But they realized, I guess, their physical capabilities, and that actually, you know, an extra 2 kilos isn't a massive thing, and that they can do things. But again, it was just educating them and pushing them in the right direction to the intensity they need to. Otherwise, I'm pretty sure there'd be guys now still be happy on 6 kilos and not progressing. But yeah, I mean, we found the same when we do speed sessions on the pitch. And I'm not sure if this is a football thing in general or a soccer thing in general, but, you know, we'd be doing speed training, trying to get these guys sort of building up to max speed. And they'd be at 75%. You know, they were ticking the box of, oh, yeah, we're doing the speed session, but they're not really, you know, attaining a decent speed. So it was trying to make it competitive with the guys and putting in races. And, you know, I jump in certain races because from my background in rugby, I'm not particularly slow. You know, I was one of the quicker guys. So all of a sudden it was, oh, this guy that's telling us to do this and getting us to do this, you know, he's racing against me. I want to beat him. And all of a sudden there was a bit more of an intensity and a bit of a challenge for the guys. So it kind of got me thinking of ways to motivate and push guys in the right direction that, you know, in a rugby environment, you wouldn't necessarily have to do. There's a very macho alpha sort of stigma to rugby. And, you know, everyone wants to lift the most and be the fastest. You don't really have to push them. If anything, you've almost got to rein them back. Whereas, you know, this experience was completely different for me. But yeah, it was a fun challenge, and, you know, the guys bought into it pretty well in the end, so call it successful.
It's funny that you mentioned that, and I know it varies from person to person, from soccer player to soccer player, but that's also been my experience working with soccer players. The majority of them, especially when you're doing max speed work, you'll see that they're holding back. I don't have access to GPS, so I don't know if that's actually the case, but from what I'm visually seeing, it seems like they're holding back.
Yeah, you can see if a guy is cruising at 75-80%, or if they're going sort of all out trying to be the fastest guy out there.
Yeah, so I thought that was actually fairly funny that it doesn't just happen here in the United States, but it seems to also be happening in Qatar.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure there's situations in the UK that, you know, clubs find them in the same situation. So it'd be interesting to sort of see what they do about that, if anything.
Yeah, and I think it's something that I'm going to be bringing up in the future just to see if that's a common trend or not.
Absolutely. I look forward to the responses to that.
So one of the reasons that I created Historic Performance is to give back to the strength and conditioning community here in the United States, give a little bit of exposure to different sports that are gaining popularity in the US. But beyond that, it's also to give some experience and recommendations to younger coaches. So what would be some recommendations that you would have for some guys coming out of university that are interested in strength and conditioning, regardless of the sport?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, if you're coming out of university trying to get into it, it's, you know, especially in the UK, it's probably a bit too late. If you know strength and conditioning is something you want to get into during university, then, you know, try and get into volunteering or interning at your college, or, you know, if you can get into a sports team, like a professional outfit, something like that. It's just lend your time and get in and, you know, experience what it's like to be in that environment and to coach. You know, I left it until I finished my undergrad. And thankfully, I knew people that could open up doors for me. But you see a lot of guys now coming out and struggling to get their foot in the door because they don't have enough experience. So if you can sort of gain some experience whilst you're studying, then, you know, that will put you ahead of the game. Make sure you get in the gym and lift yourself and just experience what it feels like. You know, read the literature and different training methodologies and play around with them yourself. You know, I'm still trial and error stuff on myself now. And I think that's the challenge of and the beauty of working in S&C is that there's no one way to skin a cat. And, you know, that it pays dividends that you can put yourself in that position so that when you have athletes coming in and they're tired and they're sore or they can't quite grasp an exercise, you've been in that position, you've experienced, you know, what it feels like to be sore or not to be able to nail an exercise first time. And it makes you a better coach because you then realize coaching cues and what works for you and what doesn't. It just opens up sort of your toolbox a bit to what you can offer to your athletes. You know, I think having worked in a multi-sport environment other than rugby and soccer, you know, you learn different tricks that carry over to different sports. And again, if you can sort of, if you are lucky enough to get experienced during your time at colleges, you know, try and sample as many sports as possible. You know, if you can get in with a basketball team or a baseball team or a football team, even rugby, you know, it's something different and a different environment and a different sport that will throw up different challenges that, you know, somewhere down the line, you might be in a completely different sport, but, you know, your time in baseball might carry over to a guy who's got a shoulder issue in football, and you can be like, well, I can take that from there. And it just adds to you as a coach and helps you distinguish yourself.
Definitely. And if you do you have any resources that you would specifically recommend, whether it be books or websites or journals that you read on a weekly or monthly basis to learn more about Rugby SNC?
Yeah, I think I'll have to give him a plug. Pierre Wenham Flat, the rugby strength coach, you know, what better place to go than to learn about rugby? So Pierre's actually working with the Argentina rugby team at the minute. So yeah, he's a great guy, very well read, who has spent a lot of time in rugby. You know, I mentioned off air to you, you know, someone like Dan Howes in Rugby Sevens, you know, he worked in the 15s, is now in Sevens. He's a great guy that's probably worth hitting up for some information on the Sevens. From a research perspective, I'd probably say Google or search on ResearchGate for Josh Darrell Jones. He's currently doing his PhD in adolescent rugby union and some stuff with rugby league there. So in terms of the research, he's a pretty good guy. Dan Baker and Tim Gabbett, anything they've done from a research perspective covers a whole spectrum of rugby. Another podcast, I'd say check out the Pacey Performance podcast. He's got a rugby special on there. You know, anything else, you know, get in touch with me and I'll try and put you in towards the right guys or the right resources in terms of rugby. But yeah, there's so many good guys out there doing great jobs within the fields, you might struggle to choose which ones to send to, but I think that's a good starting block for you there.
And I'm going to put all of those links when I publish the podcast, so everyone out there is going to have easy access to it.
Ah, perfect.
You mentioned that if people want to contact you, so what's the best way that they can reach out to you?
Probably the best way will be on Twitter. It's at AJ Oakley, like the sunglasses. Yeah, just fire me a tweet on that. My girlfriend nags me that I'm on it too much. But that's probably one of the best resources out there that I found personally for researching, for networking, you know, for asking questions. You know, it brings people together from across the pond and whatnot. So it's a great tool. So hit me up on that. I'll be more than happy to help anyone out there.
Perfect. Aiden, thanks for coming on the podcast. I greatly appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks for having me and keep up the good work.
Thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of the Historic Performance Podcast. As always, your feedback is greatly appreciated. If you have any questions or comments regarding the podcast, feel free to reach out to me via Twitter at Historic Perform. And if you have any questions for Aiden, you know, his contact information is within the published podcast on my website, and you can hit him up via Twitter. Beyond that, I just really want to thank everyone. I've been seeing the download numbers go up week in and week out, and it brings such joy to see that people from India, Brazil, Japan are logging on the podcast and listening to it. And I also think it makes our strength and conditioning and sports science community even stronger, because now people from England are being able to share their ideas with people in Japan. And I hope that with the guests that I'm bringing in from Spain and Italy, it'll bring in different ideas that are probably people in the United States and maybe in the United Kingdom haven't been exposed to. So in the end, we're only making our community stronger and providing our players with the best service possible. So thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.